Hello together. So welcome for computer graphics. We are right now speaking about the topic, or briefly started with the topic of texture mapping. And the idea of texture mapping is very simple. So as an example, you can see this simple scene here. Here you see a number of objects rendered by the state of the art that you learned or that you had up to now. So on the objects, we have lighting resulting in this shading here on the objects that also help us to perceive the shape of these objects. And what we want to apply now are textures. So textures are sorts of images that are applied to the surfaces. And yeah, these textures change material parameters of the surfaces. Yeah, so in the typical way, that means, for instance, that the diffuse color of an object is not constant for the entire object, but instead is defined by such an image that is glued on the object. Yeah? And it doesn't have to be diffuse. It could also be specular, or the specular exponent, or whatever. Yeah? You can imagine many things here. You can also apply maybe multiple textures and so on. This is what we call texture mapping. And of course, the idea is clear. You want to have simple geometry that looks visually interesting by applying these textures. And you can use such textures also maybe to fake geometry. For instance, if you look at these walls here, they have all these tiny holes in them. And of course, it would be possible to model that. But for that room, that would mean to model whatever, how many thousands of little holes, and to generate lots of triangles. But for many applications, it's just enough to take a photograph of a few of these holes and then to apply them as textures. Yeah? That makes things much faster. And for most views, it's absolutely sufficient. You won't notice the difference. OK. So textures are, we can interpret them as functions that for every point on a surface generate or deliver a certain part, a certain value for our reflectance model. So it could be color information that controls the diffuse color or whatever. Textures can be two-dimensional. That's as we saw previously in the previous examples, and that's the most typical case. So it's a 2D image that is glued onto the object that has implications, as we will see, because typically we cannot, if we have arbitrary geometry, an object with curved shape, we cannot just glue this image onto it. Yeah, it will always result in distortions, or in general, it will result in distortions, and we have to define how to map it onto that. So that's a very difficult part for textures, but textures can also be 3D. That would be a volumetric texture, and a typical example is wood, where wood has color, these rings, for instance, or other patterns, but they are not really images. They are really part of the 3D block from which an object is made. So essentially here the texture is a 3D function, and we will also see examples how this can be defined, and that has the advantage that we don't need really to assign how the texture is applied. Instead, we really take the 3D coordinate of the object as input to deliver our color. We will also see that. Good. So why do we want to use that? To make things visually more interesting and to gain performance by having simpler geometry that looks more complicated just by applying these textures. So the simplest example, or very simple example, you can see here. So we have a simple cylinder, and we have an image. And if we apply the image to the cylinder, we get this. Now, the cylinder is a very good example because, it's quite simple to map that image to the cylinder. You can do that even without distortions. I mean, you need to bend the image, but there are you don't have to stretch or squeeze it in places. But that's also not the regular case. The typical case is that you have something like this, an arbitrary 3D geometry. and an image. And if you apply them, yeah, you get something like this. But now you can already imagine. Yeah, you might say, okay, this corner of the image should end up here, and this one here, and this one here, and this one here. But how the rest is applied here in the middle is, yeah, not trivial. Yeah, you can define forces and consider this as some bendable material and glue it or somehow apply it to that surface, and then it will stretch and so on. But there are many different ways to do that. We won't really talk in detail about how to get a parameterization for that. In fact, that's exactly what we need to do for that. Yeah, how to find a mapping from here to here. What we will always assume is that such a mapping is known, and now we apply these images. Yeah, so that, for instance, if we have that triangle of our original mesh, we know, or we compute, get from somewhere in advance that exactly this part of the image should be applied to this triangle. Yeah? And this is exactly the same triangle, and you can see that exactly that part of the image, of the texture, is applied to that part, to that triangle here. Yeah, this is the problem we are facing. We will face within this chapter. Yeah, how can we apply this part of the image to this, of the texture to this triangle during rendering? Yeah, here you can see now not only this one, but how all the triangles are mapped to this texture, and yeah, how to compute these coordinates. Yeah, this is a topic we will not speak about. That's really complicated. And essentially, it's, I would say, still only not satisfactory solved problem. Yeah, this is really difficult. Okay, so texture mapping is the process that we assign reflectance information to a 3D geometric model. Up to now, we always had a material, and that was constant for the entire object. Now this is no longer the case, and we typically do that by applying a 2D function, which we call texture. And yeah, such a texture is an image, and images in computer graphics are always composited of pixels. And we will use the word texel in the following for a pixel of a texture. Yeah. So such as a pixel element, a pixel is a picture element, a texel is a texture element. Okay, so this texture mapping is, as you could see in the previous example, is more simple for a single triangle, yeah, because then the mapping is rather clear. But we will see that there are also things that we have to consider. It's not as simple as we think, maybe. But if we have a complete triangle mesh, we need a real, what we call, parameterization, a mapping to 2D. This is what we will not discuss. The generation of such textures, or textures as a whole, is a very, very important issue in computer graphics. Every movie, every animation film you see in the cinema that uses computer graphics heavily relies on these textures. Yeah? So one major challenge for artists is only to generate nice textures so that the skin of monsters looks whatever, frightening or convincing. Yeah? This is a lot of this work is done in textures. Okay, good. So now we have these images. We want to apply them. As I said, typically, or the typical images that we say one or several parameters of our reflection model are stored in in such a texture. Another way to interpret, or in maybe simpler libraries like OpenGL or old style OpenGL, textures are applied in a different way. So the typical way is to use modulation. That means when a texture is applied, it is just multiplied with a color that is achieved from normal shading. Yeah? So this texture is just multiplied onto the final image. Another way is even replace. That means no lighting at all is done, but just the polygon color is overwritten, and then there's a blending operator, but this is really hardly used. It blends between the polygon color and a texture color. Yeah, that's a pretty weird mode. But the standard way really is you have a shader. Most of you implemented shaders now. And in your shader, you really get also a value for the color from the texture, and you can use that color as you wish. You can use that to replace the specular component of your Phong model, for instance. Okay, so now there are two things we have to consider. First of all, where do the textures come from? And second, how do we apply them? And also the texture generation is an interesting problem. So the easiest way is just to take an image, yeah, and to load that. And if you type in Google textures, texture examples or whatever, you will find millions of textures. Yeah, all types of surfaces you can imagine. And you can just download these and simply use them. Yeah? So that's the simple way. A lot is available, but there are good reasons for other processes. And that's a kind of on-the-fly generation of these textures. And the first one is procedural textures. And that means your texture is not defined in an image, but again in a little program. Yeah, so how that image looks is generated as part of a program. And you could, for instance, if we come back to that whole image here, you could write a little program that really tests for every point, is it inside such a hole or not, and if, then return black, and otherwise return dark blue. Yeah, that would be a very simple example that delivers you such walls here. Yeah? But we will see that there are other even nicer, interesting textures that can be created procedurally. Another approach is texture synthesis. And here the idea is, I have no example for that, but the idea is the following. Let's assume you want to have, do we have an example here? Not really. Okay, so let's assume you want to model bark of a tree, yeah, Baumrinde. Now, this is a rather complex shape, so writing a procedure that generates that is maybe rather difficult, but you have exactly a tree with exactly the bark that you want to have outside. Yeah? So you take a photograph and you apply that, but now you have the problem, you photographed a piece of that size, but your tree is much bigger. Okay, so what you can do is that you take your pictures and you just tile them next to each other, but then the eye will immediately recognize, okay, that's one piece of bark always tiled together. So that's also a visually not very pleasant solution. So what texture synthesis does is that it takes this original picture and it generates a much larger picture from that has exactly the same structure. And in fact, it repeats little parts of the original, but it's more than just tiling it next to each other. You won't recognize, ideally, that it repeats, yeah? That it's just copies that are glued together in a nice way. And that's texture synthesis. Take a small image and generate a much larger image that has exactly the same structure without repetition. Okay, good. But that's a real research problem ongoing work, so to say. Good. But now let's have a look at procedural texture generation, because this is something which is really well understood and very often used. And the idea is that typically with procedural texture generation, structures or patterns can be computed. And it can be something like these holes, which is very simple, but it can also be much more complicated things and that also kind of fake natural appearance. And an example here, for instance, it's maybe not so good to recognize, also not so well chosen colors. An example is a texture like this here. In fact, I would say this looks a bit more like clouds, so maybe not a very good example for textures. This is generated procedurally. So there's a little program that gets us input, a coordinate, and it delivers a color. Yeah, that's a little program. And yeah, this is a type of pattern that can be generated by that. Let me briefly show you maybe more other examples that are maybe better work as textures. So here, for instance, that would be a shader that sort of looks like marble. That image does not, but this image here, I would say, looks fine. Yeah, this is really has a stone-like structure, but nevertheless, yeah, you see it's really sort of organic. Yeah, you do not see rectangular grids or whatever underlying. This is wood. Yeah, again, here it looks strange, but on a real object, it really can look like wood. Yeah. And now you see, this has some randomness in it. Yeah. In contrary to that one, yeah, this is very regular. That's easy to implement, but such a irregular pattern, or also here like the clouds, is probably more complicated. But nevertheless, this is well understood, and it's all based on a very simple idea, and this is the generation of noise. Well, this is computer graphics, so you might say, okay, why do we handle noise? With noise, we mean sort of random images. And such random images you can see here. So let's look at the rightmost image. This is really noise. Noise in the sense that every pixel in this image just has a random color. Yeah, that's a kind of image you get if you turn on your old style CRT TV, yeah, and you just give no antenna signal, then you just have this random pattern on the screen. Yeah, every pixel has a random color, and this could be called noise. But now you see, if you look at such an image, yeah, this is more than noise. It has larger features in it. Yeah, here it has a region that is brighter. Here it has a darker region. So there's a sort of coherency in the noise. But nevertheless, this is random. Yeah, and now this is modeled in the following way. That we have noise, but here we have noise which has increasing coherency. Coherency means that neighboring pixels, yeah, have similar color. It's not completely random. And what you can also see is that the coherency increases. So here it's rather small features, yeah, and the further you go to the left, the larger these features are. And in fact, this image down here is just the composition of these images. Yeah? So this picture is just noise of varying coherency summed up. Yeah? And by this you can see here, this image delivers the big structure. Yeah? You could even say, that looks like a Stanford, like this bunny object that we often have, yeah? The ears and the head. and then you add smaller and smaller features. Yeah? So even if you have large structures, if you zoom in, you find more and more details. Yeah? And that might remind you of that Mandelbrotmenge, these Apfelmännchen, yeah, where you can zoom in and you zoom in and zoom in and zoom in and you always find new little features inside. And in fact, that's the same principle. So how is this noise here with increasing coherency, how is this generated? The idea is very simple. Such coherent noise here can be generated by generating random values on a grid. Yeah, so we take a grid or put a grid onto this object, and at each position we compute a random value, and in between grid positions, we do interpolation. Yeah, this interpolation delivers us coherency, but the values themselves are random. Yeah? So we apply a grid. At each grid point, yeah, we generate a random value, and then we do interpolation. And we do very good interpolation, otherwise linear structures or whatever become visible. And this gives us such an image. And of course, these images, the difference is just the resolution of the initial grid. So here, every pixel is really random. Here, only every second pixel is random, and the others are interpolated, and so forth. Yeah? So the grid size increases, and this gives more and more coherency. OK. And yeah, so this sort of noise is called Perlin noise. Ken Perlin was the first one to describe this within the context of computer graphics. And in fact, yeah, this is still the means to generate procedural textures. There are some minor things that could be improved to make these computations faster and looking better and so on. But the general idea is used since decades. Okay, so more precisely, what is the basic idea? The basic idea of Perlin noise Perlin noise is what is called gradient noise. In contrast to what I said here, the idea is that on every grid point here, you do not define a value that is then interpolated, but instead you define the gradient at that point. So that means for a 2D example, in 1D, it would mean at the grid points, you say always the value is zero, but now you define a kind of random gradient at these points, like this. And then a function is fitted. Well, let's start like this. Yeah, that interpolates these points with these random gradients. Yeah, this is called gradient noise, and yeah, this is the such as a result. I mean, yeah, it has some advantages compared to noise where directly the positions are offset. Okay, but that's a minor issue. Then using this method to generate such images here. Yeah, all of these are images as such gradient noise or standard coherent noise with decreasing frequency and increasing grid distance. And if these are add up, you can generate such structures like wood, marble, or such. In fact, there's still a step here that for this wood here, more needs to be done, or a little more is done, that if you have, for instance, a noise function that then in the end looks like this, yeah, you say that everything above a certain threshold, for instance, should become brown, and this should become whatever, yellow. Maybe you have even another region. If it becomes even more, even larger, it becomes black. Yeah, so these are still things that you need for fine tuning. So this is not directly a noise image, but this one here to such a wood structure is really only a question of finding such good thresholds. Okay, yeah, so here we have examples, wood, marble, clouds. That's really directly the noise function shown that generates such nice clouds. And here an example with a vase of marble. Okay, a bit more precisely, how does this function work? It's the formulas are more complicated than then it's content. What this says here is that we have a uniform grid. This grid is generated by these floor and ceiling. No, it's only floor operations. So for this formula, the grid distance is 1. Yeah. And so we always take the so if we have an arbitrary point somewhere, we take the floor operation, and this gives us the left point, the point on the lower left. Then we go one step to the right, one step upwards, and one step to the right and upwards. So this gives us the four surrounding points, and between these points, we interpolate accordingly. I mean, that's what's sort of hidden in these formula. And these are blending functions that generate a smoother blending than doing linear interpolation. And this here is the function that defines our random values. It's kind of our random number generator. And yeah, also here it's interesting to see how this is done. Typically, a nice way to generate that is the following. We create a list. A quite long list, maybe, of random values. Yeah, so this is random value 0, 1, 2, 3, and so forth. Yeah, these can be filled by the standard random number generators, and there are better random number generators and worse. But we first generate such a list with maybe 100 values. Yeah, and now we want to have a random value at a particular grid position, ij. Wow. Yeah, so this is position ij, and now we want to have a random value for that. And in fact, what this formula does here is that it takes I and j, and in fact here also k, because, okay, in this example it's a three-dimensional, so we even have a three-dimensional grid position. But that's no problem. And then from these three indices, we compute an index to that table, and we take the random number at that particular position. And this index is, in that case, is computed like that. So first k is taken, and then k is to k a hash function is applied. Now, if you go back to your algorithmic lecture, yeah, in the first semester, you heard about hash functions. So that's just a function that maps k in a as random as possible order to this array here, yeah, or to a integer domain. So this gives us a kind of distributed value or random value depending on k. Then we add j and again apply the hash function, and then we add I and again apply the hash function. And this gives us a position somewhere here in the array, and then we take the random value there. Yeah, it's just a way to generate randomness which is as random as possible, so you see no regular structures, and that's not very simple to achieve, but based on a rather simple hash function, yeah, that only takes one parameter as an input, and by applying this and plugging into each other again, we shift that from 1D to 3D. Okay, but yeah, this is really, I mean, there are other possibilities to generate that, and there are different random number generators available, and so on. Yeah, so there are many possibilities to implement that. But the important part is this fractal structure here, yeah, that it's typically always composited of noise with increasing frequency, which is just added up. Okay, good. Yeah, and this is called turbulence. Yeah, this adding up noise of varying frequency. And yeah, here is a description, a formal description, how this works. So this just says that turbulence here is defined as the addition of noise with increasing frequency. I is a parameter that iterates over these frequencies, and now the frequency is increased by always multiplying the input with 2 to the power of I. Yeah? So for I equals 0, this is the noise function. If I equals 1, it's the noise function shrunk to half the size, and so forth. So what you can see here is that, in fact, if I go back, that this image here, or no, this one, is just a scaled version of this one. So it's 1/4 somewhere from here, maybe, or from anywhere else, 1/4 increased in size, enlarged in size, So in fact, as a basis, you only need one of these images, and then the others are even derived from that. That's what we see here, So it's always the same noise function. And additionally, this noise, so with increasing frequency, the amplitude is reduced. That means the finer the detail, the smaller also the amplitude. That makes perfect sense. Otherwise, you would have this fine noise here. This here, if it would have the same amplitude as this here, the result would be noise again. It would just be too strong. Okay. So that's turbulence. Here, an example. Here we see a noise function. That's again values interpolated, random values interpolated. Here we see scaled versions of that. So you see the beginning here is exactly the same as up here, but here the right part was not visible here. So we continue with the noise here on the right, and this gives the right half. And then again, scaled in x direction and in y direction. The amplitude gets smaller and smaller. And here we have something that really looks like noise already, and here even more. Hardly any coherence, but also the amplitude is small. And if we add this together, we get this here. And this is something which we find visually interesting. Okay, good. So, that's point one. How can we generate textures? Either we load it from an image, or we use such a procedural model that generates something simple like this here, or something more complex, typically using this noise pattern here. And this defines our textures. Okay, now the next interesting question is, how can we apply these textures to our objects? And I don't want to skip always, but maybe, no, that was too far. Okay, so we had this example here. And here now the idea is that for this triangle, we sort of said, we want to take that part of the image. And in fact, this already describes how we define this mapping. What we do, in fact, is that for every vertex of our original mesh, we define which position on the image should this point show. So here, the yellow point, for instance, with this yellow point, we store this position in the image. And with this red point, we store this position, and with this, we store this position. And this position in the image is just a coordinate in the texture, and this is why we call this texture coordinates. So that means if we want to apply a texture to that object, the first thing, or the second thing, first we need a texture, and then the second thing is that for every point of this mesh, we need a texture coordinate. We need to define which point of the texture should be mapped to this point of our mesh. And this texture coordinate typically is really an attribute of the vertex. That means that it is shared for all the surrounding triangles. That also means that the image is not torn, It's really is distorted, but it's not torn. It's distorted and applied to that image here. Okay, so that's the second thing that we need if we want to do texturing for every point, for every 3D point, or for every vertex of our mesh, we need a texture coordinate. Yeah? And these texture coordinates are typically called S and T, yeah, or U and V, but S and T is the typical name. If we have 3D textures, it would be S, T, and R. And we will later also see that it makes perfect sense to even have four-dimensional texture coordinates where these are homogeneous texture coordinates. That means to get the real position, we have to divide S, T, and R all by Q. This makes perfect sense. And it brings us back that, again, we have four-dimensional vectors. And in these shading languages, everything is 4D. And so also homogeneous or texture coordinates are 4D to be able to store such homogeneous coordinates. Okay, and then for every point of our surface, we need such a texture coordinate. And this now is typically done in a very simple manner. We assign S and T to the vertices, and for interior points, these texture coordinates are achieved by interpolation. Yeah? So we define the texture coordinates at the vertices of our mesh, and the rest is done by interpolation. Okay, and now you might say, okay, problem solved. We know how to do it. But if you try that, you will quickly run into problems. So let's look at this example. That's a simple texture, yeah, a checkerboard. Here we have a quad. So this could be a square. So it fits perfectly with that texture, but a square looked at under perspective, yeah, so it becomes a quadrilateral. And now we want to apply that image to that square and to get an image, we want to get an image like that. Yeah? That's what we would expect. We will see that this interpolation here, yeah, we only have the texture coordinates at the vertices. So for points in between, we somehow need to interpolate. Yeah, and this makes things difficult. I immediately go to that one. If you do that not correctly, you get this result. So what happened here? Well, we want to interpolate our texture coordinates, yeah, and we have a quadrilateral. So so we need to interpolate on a quadrilateral. We haven't done that yet, how to do that correctly. And in fact, there are many possibilities to do that. But we know how to do that on triangles. Yeah, and in fact, in most libraries, every quadrilateral that you render is split into two triangles and rendered as two triangles. Yeah, so let's say this quad here is split along this axis into two triangles. Yeah, and then on each of these two triangles, the interpolation is done separately and linearly using barycentric coordinates, yeah, as you all know and can immediately derive in an oral axiom. So if you do so, you get this result. And this is obviously wrong. Yeah? And in fact, if for some reason here it was decided to split the square here along this diagonal, then the result would again look different. Yeah? That's not what you want. You want this here. And yeah, here we can also show or maybe explain the problem a little bit. Let's say this is the original texture, and now we look at it under a perspective. And what we did here now is that first we rendered these three lines here, and we took uniform distance in this direction. Yeah. So in screen space, we split this quad here into four quarters. And we did the same here. Yeah, we split this edge, and we split this edge, and then we apply or we render the lines. Yeah? And if you look at that, and you're a little bit used to looking at perspective images, yeah, then you realize this is wrong. Here, these cells here are no longer squares. Yeah, under perspective, they get longer here. These are rectangles. Yeah, and how it should look like is this here. I mean, here everything is a rectangle. So, the cells or these distances should become smaller in the back. Yeah, not uniform like here. So obviously, with perspective, we run into problems. And now again, another way to look at that is the following: if we take the diagonal here and add this diagonal, it's not too well chosen, but under this view we see that these intersections are still all at the right positions, yeah, compared to here. And but what we do when we do this wrong interpolation using triangles, yeah, we separately do an interpolation on the lower left and on the upper right triangle, and this gives us this example here. Yeah, that's just another visualization of that problem. Yeah, so this is wrong. Splitting into two triangles and doing a linear interpolation on both of the triangles is wrong. Yeah, and this is right, but obviously this is another kind of interpolation that we haven't done yet. And yeah, this effect, the stronger the perspective gets, yeah, the larger the depth difference between the single points on the object gets, the worse this gets. So if we take these points and move them further to the back or rotate the object, yeah, so that perspective becomes stronger, then the effect becomes even worse. Yeah, this is the right view and this is the wrong one. So obviously there's something going wrong and we have to think about good interpolation. And this is what is called perspective interpolation. Yeah? So we need an interpolation that takes into account perspective. And obviously we need more information now, because if you look at that example, this perspective here is generated because these points are further away. Yeah? But it could also be, I mean, obviously it's not the case, but it could also be that these points are as close as these and we have a trapezoid. Yeah? We have just a trapezoid and we look at it, so it's parallel to the view plane, and then this distortion would look very different. Yeah? then in fact the previous one would be the right solution, or another solution would be right. I should correct that. Yeah. It's obviously, when doing interpolation, we also really need to know the three-dimensional position of these objects. We need to know how far are these points away and how far are these points away. And we need to know that to do correct interpolation. Okay, good. So now we have to look at that closer, because we saw that obviously linear interpolation in screen space is not the right thing. And yeah, looking at this, now we have to drop one dimension, but this is perfectly fine, and have to look at the viewing situation from the side. So in this image here, we see in this direction we assign the x-axis, and this direction is the z-axis. That means that's the distance from the camera, and let's say the camera is now here. It's not at z equals 0, it's a bit further back, but okay, that doesn't play, it's not important. So here's the camera, this is the view direction, and now we look at one image dimension, which we call x here. Now this is our image plane, yeah? And now we have a line, and we want to texture this line. Yeah, this is our object in world space, which we want to texture. And Now texture coordinates, for simplicity, we say this here has texture coordinate 0 and this has texture coordinate 1. Yeah, or we want here 0 and here 1. Later on we can say S0 and S1, but that doesn't make a difference. Okay, so we want to apply a texture to that one, and the positions here are chosen such that this point, yeah, is just in the middle of the two. Yeah? So this point is a texture coordinate 0.5. It's really just in between here and here. Now if we look at the projection to image space, yeah, we see this line is projected to this line. So this is our line in image space. But now we see that the projection of the center point is no longer in the center. Yeah? That's one property that we had with projective transformations. That is that ratios are not preserved. Maybe you remember that. That means a point that is here in the center after the projective mapping is no longer in the center. Now, this is exactly what happens here. And this is also what happens here. So if we take of our texture the center point, we can construct that by computing the intersection of the diagonals. The center point will be somewhere here. Yeah? It's much further to the right than here. Linear interpolation would mean the center point is here, but in fact it's here. That's exactly this offset. Okay, so we understood the problem, yeah, and we can make a drawing to explain where this problem comes from. But now, of course, we also want to find a solution. Yeah? So we want to find a way that, now let me try to phrase what we want, in fact. We have given a line in 3D. We have texture coordinates at the beginning and at the end point. And in world space, we want to have a linear interpolation. On this line, we want to apply our image without any perspective distortions or so. Yeah? So that means if we want to apply our checkerboard texture, yeah, then all the in-world space, yeah, all the single squares should have same size. Yeah? In world space, we want to have linear interpolation here. But now this interpolation is sort of projected into image space. Yeah? And by projection, now here an interpolation is generated that is not linear. But on the other hand, the rasterization is done here in image space. Yeah? When we rasterize our image, yeah, we go through the pixels on the triangle, and we do that in image space, obviously. So what we have is that we are somewhere here in our image at a particular position. We know where we are within this image, so we have we know where within this line we are. We can describe that by a parameter t, which is 0 down there and 1 up here. Yeah, and now for this t, we want to find out what is the correct s for that. Yeah, and this is not identity. Yeah, we want to convert this t to this s here, yeah, to map that back. Okay, yeah, so we need a mapping of t to s that really considers perspective. This is not very simple. Here we have here you can find a link where this derivation is described in detail. It's also not too easy to understand, it's everything is written down. So let me try to follow the important ideas here. Yeah, so again, let's look at this example, but what we now also need are coordinates of these points in 3D. So this point has coordinate x1, z1, and this point has x2, z2. Obviously, we need these. Yeah? So if we move this point from here to here, we exactly have the same situation on the left, but the mapping is obviously different. Yeah? So the mapping needs to know where in space are we, and not only the projection. Okay, now every point on this line can be described by this formula here. Yeah, this is the starting point plus s times the vector from here to here. This is the vector from end from beginning to end, and s times the vector gives us any point here. Yeah? Okay. Now, with some arithmetics, and here I really refer to that paper here, we find the following, that the following connection between this parameter t and this parameter s here. Yeah? S is the position on the line in world space, and t is the position on the line in image space. And yeah, with some arithmetics, we can find this relation here. And one nice thing is that, obviously, this mapping only, or the way it, as it is written down, this mapping only depends on the depth values, only on set 1 and set 2. Yeah? That means later on, if we have our triangles and we want to do correct interpolation, we just, in addition to x and y, we need to know the set coordinate of these points to do the correct interpolation. Yeah? The depth coordinate. I mean, x and y we have anyhow because these are the positions in screen space. And these are, these are the set, so this gives us the relation, but now it's, this tells us if we are at position t in screen space, what is the real texture coordinate in world space that we need to apply. So in this example here, if we plug in concrete numbers, this point here is at, this one should be down here. This somehow moved. So this should be here. Yeah? So this point has s equals 0, and its set coordinate is 1/2. And here we have set coordinate 3/2 and s equals 1. And now with these two values, 1/2 and 3/2, we can plug this into our formula, and then a point which is here at 3/4 in s is at 1/2. Yeah? And this you can really measure these lengths here. You will see that this is correct. Yeah? So this allows us to transform this t to this s. And this is exactly what we need. Okay, good. So that's the kind of basis. So now let's assume, or let's make this a little bit more general. Let's assume we have this line, and we have two attributes for this line. Yeah? For the beginning, this will be texture coordinates, but later on we will see it can be anything. Yeah, it could also be a color or whatever. Also, these can be perspectively correctly interpolated. Yeah? So we have an attribute A1 here at the beginning of the line and an attribute A2 at the end of the line. And now we want, for a particular point at t, we want to find out what's the correct interpolation, and not the interpolation in image space, but here in world space. And now we exactly take this s that we have here. So on a particular point here, the interpolated attribute is this. Yeah? And so for a position t, the interpolated attribute is this value. Now this looks a bit complicated, right? Yeah? So essentially, this is the formula that we want to compute. Yeah? We have a t given. And we want to find the attribute value at this position, but being projected here into that space. But we can see that these denominators here, or it's only two denominators that happen or that appear. It's 1 over set 1 and 1 over set 2. And in fact, we can... If we look at that a little bit closer, we can find the following idea. So the nominator here, yeah, is nothing else but an interpolation of A1 over set 1 2A2 over Z2, and it's an interpolation in image space. Yeah? It takes T as a parameter. T is the image space parameter. So this here is an interpolation of A1 over Z1 to A2 over Z2 in image space. And the same is true down here. This is an interpolation of 1 over Z1 to 1 over Z2 also in image space. So the nominator and the denominator are interpolations in image space. And now with denominator, you should immediately think about homogeneous coordinates. Yeah? If we say that we do this entire computation using homogeneous coordinates, then we could put this into the homogeneous component. Yeah? And this is the regular component. So what this boils down to is the following idea. If we want to interpolate, so let's say texture coordinates, that's the simplest attribute. What we interpolate is not S and T, but instead it's S over Z and T over Z. Yeah, so that's these values. We interpolate these, and in addition, we interpolate 1 over Z. That will become the denominator. Yeah, so we interpolate the first S over Z and T over Z, this gives us the nominator. And the common denominator does not depend on the attribute, it only depends on the Z value. So whatever attribute you take, the denominator is the same. Yeah? So that's why it's perfect for homogeneous coordinates. So we interpolate S over Z and T over Z and 1 over Z. Yeah? And we interpolate them in screen space with barycentric coordinates as we are used to. And then for a particular pixel, we get the interpolated value S over Z, T over Z, and 1 over Z, and then we divide them. Yeah, and you see, if we divide this by 1 over Z, what we get is S. Yeah? And this S now is perspectively, from a perspective point of view, is correctly interpolated. Yeah? Okay. So, maybe just to make that clear once again, we have an attribute, or in that case, two attributes, that is S and T, per vertex. And now during rasterization, we do not directly interpolate S and T, but instead, for each of these vertices, we know the Z component. Yeah? We know the distance to the camera. Yeah? We did all these computations in 3D. So the attributes that we interpolate are now the attributes divided by this set value of that particular point. Yeah? So the attribute of this value over set, the attribute of this value over the set value of this vertex, and here the attribute over the set value of this vertex. And additionally, we interpolate 1 over set of the single components, of the single vertices. We interpolate that. And here we do another division, and we get the correctly interpolated attribute. Yeah, so that's quite simple. Yeah, and it's if you know how to do it, it's very easy to integrate in rasterization. We do the interpolation as we learned to do it for Gouraud shading, for instance. Yeah, but we interpolate one value more, this 1 over Z, and then we have to do one additional division here at that point, and we get a perspective correct interpolation. Yeah? So that's really quite simple, and it is the one that exactly delivers this result in contrast to this result. Yeah? And in fact, this does not only work for texture coordinates, it works for any attribute. So if you also have colors, for instance, that are to be interpolated, or for lighting results, that are to be interpolated, this works always. And in OpenGL, if you write a pixel shader, you always get interpolated attributes from the vertices, right? Yeah, you compute values with the vertices in the vertex shader, and these are interpolated and brought to the pixel shader. And by default, all these attributes use a perspective correct interpolation. Yeah? That means you don't have to take care about that. So you might say, okay, why did I learn it then? I think at least you should understand that something is going on there. So if you take S and T, compute S and T at the vertices, so store it with the vertices in your fragment shader, you get a perspective correct interpolation of these values. Okay. Good. So, that's one interesting thing. Then, something that is very, very, very simple in comparison. S and T are, as I said, these texture coordinates are typically in a range of 0 to 1. But, in fact, it might be interesting to use larger ranges. So, let's say, for example, let's come back here to this one. So let's say we take this little square, and we take a picture of that and say this is our texture, and now we have a larger triangle, that goes like this. Then we would somehow have a way to take this little texture and to say, okay, tile it next to each other, so that if we access this point, in fact, it's this one. So that it really does this periodicity build that in, and then we can just take three-dimensional or real coordinates as texture coordinates, and we can also take texture coordinates larger than one. It just needs to be continuous. In fact, this is one of three typical modes that are used for texture coordinates outside the range from 0 to 1. And this is here we can see it in this example. So let's assume we have this texture. It's a checkerboard with 8x8 squares. And if we have now a larger square, and this has texture coordinate 0, 0, and here texture coordinate 2, 0, here 2, 2, and here 0, 2. Now, here we have this periodicity, this repeat pattern, by simply using the following formulas for that are applied to texture coordinates. And this is simply S and T are mapped to the fraction of S and T. And the fraction is just the number minus the floor. So it's just the part after the point in a fractional number. So when turning on repeating, for every S and T to look up the texture, first S and T, the fractional parts are computed, and these are used to look into the texture. And that means if we go from 0 to 1, we get the original texture, and as soon as we are over 1, we go back to 0 and repeat again. So this gives us this simple repetition. An alternative is to use clamping, and this simply means whenever you're larger than 1, the texture coordinate is set back to 1. And the same, of course, on the left, when we get smaller than 0, we're set back to 0. In this example, it would deliver this result. For this texture, it's probably not what we want. Good. So that's an additional step that we can do to make this tiling simpler. But now we still face the problem that our S and T values, our texture coordinates, are not integer values. That means we access our texture somewhere at an arbitrary position, somewhere in between our pixel centers. Now it's a very interesting question. How we can do this interpolation that becomes necessary then. And in fact, this is what is typically in the context of textures called filtering, because as we will see, this problem requires more than only interpolation. And this is another very interesting problem in the context of texturing. So again, here an example. This is our texture grid. So these are the single texels. For each of these texels, we have a color value. And now we have a position, ST, and this is somewhere in between. this is somewhere in between, in this example, let's say 4 pixels. Yeah? And now we have to find a new value or an interpolated value for S and T based on its surrounding. We have to interpolate something. Okay, and now the simplest ways, probably already did that in other contexts. That's very simple. The simplest solution would be, if I have a point here, I take the color of the nearest texel. Or in this example, I just look up the color of the texel my point resides in. Yeah? So if we are here, then we take the color of this texel value here. Essentially, that just means that we use such a floor operator. We scale the texture coordinate by the number of pixels we have in x direction, and then we take the floor operator, and this gives us the texel index we are in. And that would mean if we have this texture, this only has 2 by 2 pixels, and if we apply that to that square, we get this image here. Yeah? It's essentially no interpolation. Everything here is red, everything here is blue, here is green, and here is black. Yeah? That's probably the fastest way, because no interpolation is really necessary. But it's probably not the way that you typically want. What you might expect is that if you have such a texture and you do interpolation, that you get something like this here. Yeah? And what is done from here to here is bilinear interpolation. Yeah, I'm pretty sure you know bilinear interpolation. And here are the corresponding formula. First, we compute So we have our grid of texel values. Then we have a new position we are interested in, that's S and T. Now we compute the coordinates within this square, so that's S prime and T prime. So these are values between 0 and 1 that tell us where within this square cell we are. And with that we do simple bilinear interpolation. Yeah, that's simple. We first interpolate in x direction and then in y direction and so on. You know that. And this delivers this result. Okay, that's fine. Yeah, but if we apply that, we quickly find out that we run into problems. This is shown in this example. Yeah? Now we have, again, this checkerboard texture. And we apply that to a large square or to an infinite plane, let's say. Yeah? With repetition, we can do that. And now here in the front, we can see that, here in the front, where the single pixels of our textures are enlarged, here, a single pixel of the texture covers several pixels of our screen. Yeah? So here we are in the enlargement region or in the magnification region. And here, we can see differences between bilinear and nearest neighbor interpolation. Yeah? Because if we are in the transition region, the first one always gives us a hard transition from black to white. And if we do interpolation, we also have gray values in between. Yeah, that remind a little bit of anti-aliased lines, where we also avoid jaggies by using gray values in the transition region. Yeah, this is here in the magnification region. Yeah, we get this anti-aliasing by using bilinear interpolation. Okay, but the problematic region obviously here is not when we do magnification, but here in the background when we do minification. Yeah, what happens here now is that many pixels from the texture are mapped to a single pixel in screen. Or the other way around, every pixel on the screen contains several black and white squares. Yeah? So in one single pixel, we see an entire board with 8 by 8 pixels, for instance. And now you can imagine what happens. Because now if we always take from our image, now we are in image space. This is an image pixel. Yeah? And now typically for the center point of that image, we compute the texture coordinate, or we know the texture coordinate. Yeah? So we take this, go into our checkerboard image, and we learn, okay, this point is here. Yeah? And this one is black, so we make it black. Now, due to the minification, if this point was only a little bit to the right, yeah, this point would have mapped to here, yeah? Would have made a much further jump. And here, by random, it is white. Yeah? So just moving a little bit to the right immediately makes that color of the entire pixel changing from black to white. So essentially, this mapping here becomes sort of random. Yeah? So depending on if we sample here, we get black. A little bit more to the right, we get white. Then here we get black again. Here we get white. Here we get black. Yeah, that's completely or uncorrelated. And this results in these weird patterns down back there. Yeah? And now this is a really difficult problem. And it's, again, an aliasing problem. And it's something that we really have to take a look at. And yeah. Okay. So in fact, we can describe this problem as a sampling problem. And there's a very well-known machinery to describe all these sampling problems. And yeah, this is what we will have a look into. And so maybe I can best describe this looking at a real example again. So let's assume we have the following situation. So this is the current scan line. Yeah, we do scan line rendering. So we have a scan line, and these are the pixels of our scan line. Here, the little circles are the centers of our pixels. Yeah? So these are the points for which we do the color computation, yeah, the lighting computation or the texture lookup. So now let's assume we apply a texture, and this is the texture. Yeah? And now we are in the sort of safe mode. That means magnification. Yeah? The single pixels of the texture are larger than the texels are larger than the pixels. Okay? Good. So, yeah, this blue one is a single texel. Now, what will be the result? So, for this pixel, we will get blue. For this, we get blue. For this, we get white. Here, we get white. Then, we get red, white, white, green. So, this is the result. Yeah? And it's not perfect because you see the blue pixel, the blue texel gets two pixels, yeah, whereas the red texel only gets one pixel. So yeah, it's blue. There's too much blue, but nevertheless, the overall structure still is sort of kept. Yeah? So that's not perfect, but it's okay. And if we do bilinear interpolation, then the situation even becomes better, because then in this case, the one on the left would become reddish, and this one would become reddish, and overall, it's okay. Yeah? Good. Now, let's come to this case. And here now, a texel is exactly as large as a pixel. Yeah? So we are now just in the range where, in this image, this will be probably somewhere here. This is exactly the range where a pixel becomes as large as a texel, yeah? Where one square becomes one pixel large. OK, now this is perfect. Yeah? Because now this pixel becomes blue, this one becomes white, this one becomes red, white, green, white, yellow, white. So it's a kind of one-to-one copy of the texture to the screen. That's perfect. Yeah? So we have a really direct copy. But of course, yeah, in that image, this is exactly one line. Yeah? And we cannot control that. The texture frequency the size of this texture is out of our control. This is part of the model. Yeah? The modeler decided how large should that texture be, And we can also not decide about the size of our pixels. Yeah, they are built in our screen. Yeah, so we cannot change them. Okay, yeah, so in very rare cases, we have the optimal case. And now let's look at the next case. And this is the problematic one. Now, if the texture is shrunk, the texels are smaller than the single pixels, what do we get? Yeah, well, here we get white. Then this red pixel is never hit. The next one is white again. Then green is missed. Then we get white again. Yellow is missed. White again. Blue is missed. White is missed. And we get red, yeah, and so forth. And we get this result. Yeah, that's very weird. Yeah. It's a sort of random values picked out of this original texture. And this is exactly what happens here, yeah, here in the background. Yeah. You see sort of random patterns that happen here. Yeah, and you have, for instance, cases or lines. Somewhere here there are probably lines where the pixels are exactly twice as large as the texels, and in that case, you only hit every second texel, and you only hit black texels. Yeah, so you get a complete line black. And if you move the plane a little bit, it might happen that in the next frame you get all whites for this line. Yeah, so it's a horrible flickering, and it really looks more like, or it is noise, in fact, instead of something reasonable. Okay, and yeah, so computer graphics were not the first to see that problem. I mean, maybe the first to see that problem because it's a visual problem, but this problem appears also in many other scenarios, and mainly also with audio signals or whatever other electric signals that are sampled. So a typical example would be a CD is the wrong example. An MP3, yeah, where you have a signal, and this is sampled at certain times, typically 40,000 times per second. And here, very similar effects can happen. Yeah? So if you sample a signal that has 40 kilohertz, and you sample it 40,000 times a second, very weird things can happen. Yeah? And if you sample, or if the frequency is even higher, you get exactly this effect here in terms of audio, and you suddenly hear frequencies that were not there in the original example. And but the good news is that there's a very nice and elegant theory on that. Some of you maybe are aware of that and heard that in other lectures, but nevertheless, I will repeat that here for computer graphics because it also helps us to derive what should we have to do against that, and how can we solve the problem. And in particular for textures, that's very well visible. And since this is a larger thing to look at, I would say I cancel or stop the lecture for today, and we will do that then on next Tuesday. Thank you, and see you on Tuesday.